Welcome to another episode of the Five Senses Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Zinni, and today in studio we have Mark Stutzman. He is a veteran video director for tours, and he's been on tours with amazing and famous artists such as Prince, Michael Jackson, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, and Drake. How are you doing, Mark? Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So, you have been on tour for about 40 years, doing a variety of different topics, but your main talent or your main passion, if you will, is video directing these tours. Is that correct?
Video directing and camera work, and some tours I engineered. It just varies between tour. I love doing camera work. I would say that's my passion is camera work, but I've also gotten into directing also. Yeah, I kind of phased out of engineering a bit, but it's camera work was my forte. But like I said, I direct too, so a little bit of everything.
How has the touring industry been affected of the pandemic?
Oh, dramatically. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything in all my time in 50 years like this. It's shut it down. It's literally shut every avenue, not only from the huge live shows that I'm accustomed to doing, even the smaller shows. I mean, it just affected everybody.
Right. So you've been in the touring business since the 60s, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So there's a lot. You said there's a lot of components in the behind the stage for these acts, right? So you're the behind the scenes person for like Prince and Journey, Taylor Swift, Drake, and it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. So how has that been impacted so far of the tours?
Well, these tours are set up quite a bit in advance, and so when this thing hit, people were already to start going out again. It was kind of, you know, the first few months before that, say January and February, people were kind of prepping the tours, and then when it hit March, people were ready to go out, and people were all set to start touring again. That, you know, they had invested time and energy and money in the preparation of the tours through the booking. You know, some of these venues have to be booked, you know, years in advance, and all that stuff was when this hit. Once the big guy Live Nation shut the doors for most of the large venues, or the ones that I'm mostly directly related to, literally it shut every person I knew in the business down.
Okay.
And I've never in my life have seen that in all the years I've been doing it. Through AIDS, through SARS, through all the other diseases that we've gone through in the last 20 years or more, it's just shut everything down. And it's almost like, for me personally, I'm more worried, I'm 10 times more worried about getting another gig than I'm worried about getting the virus, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I've been around the world. I've gone through, you know, yellow fever. I've gone through all the other stuff in South America. Nothing has got me, you know, so far in 40 plus years of touring. And it's ironic that it's just, and it's just my opinion, if, you know, if I had a tour offer tomorrow, I wouldn't think twice about going on tour. That's nice. Me personally.
Right. Well, that's your lifestyle. And so let's get into your lifestyle a little bit. So you are a tour videographer director. What does that entail?
It entails cutting the show, cutting the live show. Whether it's my most recent one was Train and the Goo Goo Dolls. I was doing about a 10 camera mix on that, manned and unmanned cameras. So I cut that show. Then I cut the opening act normally too, and that was the Goo Goo Dolls. And that takes a combination of, on that particular tour, it was on the production side, it was the engineer, which basically sets up the racks and all the gear. And then we get the camera set up, and that's kind of our end of the spectrum. Then there's another crew that basically does the LED portion of it. Normally, most tours have LED. And then if there's projection, there's normally a projectionist that sets up the side screens or projection screens. That's the gist of it all. But I'm the guy, the buck stops with me. I deal with the artist. If whatever shots they like, they don't like, things, little idiosyncrasies that comes along, hey, I don't want to be shot from this side. I don't like, you know, whatever artist is, you know, you have to communicate with these artists. Mm-hmm. Some of them are very easy to communicate with. Some are not. Like I say, it's just everyone's a unique characteristic. So you have to be able to imagine, you know, we probably have 4 or 5 people that help us, our whole crew, our video crew. There's multiple crews, or video crews, lighting crews, sound crews, you know, carpenters, set people, you know, and on and on and on. You get stage hands when you go to all these venues because you can't really do it all yourself. Unloading the truck, setting it up, doing the show, tearing it apart, putting it back in the truck. That's basically, you're doing that in the course of 10 hours. And then you're off to the next town doing the same thing. You get on a bus, you wake up at the next town, 100, 200, 300, 400 miles away, you get up and do it again. And that's the name of the game.
Nice.
And whatever you do in between, if you get back on the bus and you feel like having 2 beers, like most people do, say, or some people have more.
Okay.
And wake up with an outrageous hangover, or don't wake up. And if they do, for on my crew, if you have one chance, if you miss the stage call the first time, that's your chance. If you're late the next time, I just call the office to send me another guy.
Oh, all right.
That's the name of the game for me. I mean, if I'm there, you're going to be there, you know. I mean, again, there are some extenuating circumstances sometimes, but normally the majority of the people that get into my side of the business, I would say between 50 and 70% of them last about maybe 2 or 3 years at the most, because most people can't handle the lifestyle. It's a being away from your family, your loved ones, your dog, your whatever. Everybody says they can do it. Everybody says, oh man, this is perfect. But imagine you're the kid in the candy store. When you get on that bus at night, nobody's going to tell you, hey, stop drinking so much beer. Hey, stop smoking so much pot. Hey, stop doing whatever. It's up to you. Okay. Nobody's there to babysit you. You're your own person. And like I said, so that's why I have a pretty strict rule. I don't care what you do. You can get stone drunk if you want to, but if you're not there ready to work full capabilities the next day, then you're not cut out for this. And like I said, everybody thinks they can do it, but I've had the majority of the people they'll fizzle out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, life on tour, you know, the constant traveling, then the different variables that could happen when you're driving on the bus or the plane, could really impact the entire production. And from my understanding, you have, let's say, Prince or Taylor Swift or Drake, that is the main act. But then how many people are involved with just going to put that show on from venue to venue? And what does it take to create those shows each night?
Oh, lots and lots of people. Like I say, there's so many people behind the scenes, and on a small roster, thinking of, let's just say, the train show that we did, the train with the Goo Goo Dolls, there was probably, and this is a pretty, for me, it's a pretty small one, it would be about 40 to 50 people, a traveling crew. And then we hire another probably 30 or 40 people at each venue for the stage crew. That's a pretty small one.
Who are some of your favorite bands or performers that you like to work on their productions for?
You know, there's quite a few. I would say, you know, the top of my head, Michael, of course, was one of the, you know, just because he was such a perfectionist. He had such a good show. He knew everything about the production. When we were in rehearsals, you know, he would be, we were rehearsing at Sony Studios, and this is for the Bad Tour in 87. And we'd be in production doing the thing and going over. I mean, we were in there for months, over a month doing production on this. And it was always ironic because you know, any move that he'd make, do his thing. You know, the camera shots had to be there, but he also knew every single lighting cue and every sound cue too. He knew everybody's cue. He was one of the few guys that I know that just he knew everything, and he did his own, you know, dancing and singing and all that stuff. And he knew if that light was late or if that cue was late. He was on top of his game, and it was such an interesting production. Again, this is the Bad Tour, and this is when he had his sometimes he'd have his animals out there. His two chimpanzees, Bubbles and Bubba, would sit out right by the mixing console, and he had two little chairs sitting out there for him, and they would sit there in these little chairs, watch the production, and I got to know the trainer pretty well, and I always would play with the chimpanzees. They'd hold them on their arm and they'd lift them up, and they were really well-behaved animals, and they would sit at the table with us when we'd be eating, you know, dinner together sometimes, and it was pretty cool. Sit next to the chimpanzees and stuff. It was good. It was, like I said, that production was, I mean, it was just like when you come into town, it was like the circus coming into town with the biggest show in the world at that time. I mean, we were doing shows all over the world. That tour was 18 months long, around the world twice. I mean, but when we would come in town, it was like we took over. I mean, we literally, if we were playing Germany, we were playing the Olympic Stadium. And that was when he was doing the guy that would fly into the arena over the top of the arena, you know, with the jetpack thing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it was supposed to be Michael, but it wasn't Michael, but there was somebody doing that. I mean, and all those effects that he had on there, all the illusions and all that kind of stuff were done. He was very good friends with Siegfried and Roy. And all those illusions that were designed in that show were from them. He designed those specifically for Michael, for them. And it was just, like I said, it was a really, really fun tour, because you just, like I said, you just came in, you're not invading, but you're just coming into town. And you're like, you know, when we were coming into Japan, it was just like, we played the Egg Dome there. It's, that Egg Dome holds 70,000 people.
Oh, okay.
And we did 11 shows there. You know, we're there, we were in Tokyo for a month. We took, you know, when he rented a hotel, they're like, he rented X amount of floors of the whole hotel, of the Princess or whatever. And when we come in, and it was amazing. You had all the people in Japan that were just, it was ironic because they didn't know to speak to you, and they didn't know English, but they knew every single word of the song. And so you come up to hear somebody singing the song, and you try to converse with them, but they didn't understand what you're saying, but they knew every single word of the song. You know, and it was a really good experience. The whole tour on that tour was just a great tour. And I had one time he wanted to go to, this was when Disneyland first opened up over there in Tokyo. And he said, hey, I want to go and see the Disneyland. So what they did is they closed Disneyland down for the day and let our crew come in with about 250 people.
Okay.
And you went on as many rides as you wanted going. And, had as much fun, and we did a thing at the we had a group supper at the Pirates of the Caribbean, and I remember sitting at that end of the table with him and the chimpanzees and all that. I was friends with the guy, and it was fun being around the animals, and I just remember us all sitting around there at Pirates of the Caribbean having dinner with Michael Jackson in his red jacket.
That's a great benefit to have. Not only you get to tour the world, be around music, but then you get some really cool benefits like that.
There was quite a few, yeah, with him. It was very cool, very cool.
So we talked about a little bit about the business aspect of your lifestyle. Could you talk about like the benefits of this traveling lifestyle? Like you get to go see the world. Like what's in it for you, not professionally, but as a person? What's it like going on tour and experience the world?
The big thing for me was like you had mentioned, touring all over the world from Russia to China, and I'm a big photographer, and I've always shot a lot of stills. You know, I've had some published but just being a photographer and being able to go, you know, into Russia, shooting the Chapel of the Blood and St. Petersburg, and just shooting all these chapels and shooting, you know, just shooting pictures of, you know, daytime, nighttime shots of these fabulous places, you know, along the Great Wall of China, shooting, you know, stuff in, and into the Kyoto Castle in Japan, and just so many different places I've been, and I've got thousands and thousands of pictures of stuff that I've shot. And then there's always the parties. They throw some pretty good parties, and yeah. Like I say, you know, imagine being in Europe somewhere, and let's just say Prince. You know, we'd do a show with Prince, and then he would also he had a crew that did their main job was to organize an after party show.
Okay.
And normally, sometimes the video crew would shoot live video of it. And sometimes we would just go, like some of the rest of the crew would just go to have fun. And it was always unique because I could remember times that I would be sitting at like a little 1,000-seater club after we just played, you know, something maybe a 30,000-seater arena. And we go to this little 1,000-seater club. And as you would drive up to this place, it was like, you know, somehow the public would find out that you're coming. And there'd be thousands of people there. And we'd drive up in our tour bus and it was like, somebody would just part the sea, you know, so the crew could get by. And if you happen to see somebody that you like, to say, hey, you feel like coming in? And she'd say, yeah. And say, well, come on in here with me. And then you go into the club and have a party. And he threw some great parties.
Nice.
That was Prince. And a lot of them did. But Prince was really unique because he like Michael, had an air about him. There was a mystique. I mean, he just had a unique style of using that microphone and microphone stand that ultimately he really got a lot of it from James Brown. If you look at some of the old James Brown stuff, all that spinning and now like the way his style is.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a couple of videos that we had shot that, you know, that shows that he, the kicking and that stuff is a lot to do with James Brown. Was the guy that, you know, everybody, no matter who you are, at some point in your early career, you're going to, you know, emulate somebody.
Right.
I mean, that's how you learn and stuff.
Well, I never got to see Prince perform live, but I heard it was a very mixture of that funk air with R&B, dance, and he, like, a lot of people don't understand that Prince was one of the best guitarists, you know, of his generation, if not ever.
Well, he not only was a great guitarist, he was a great everything else.
Right.
He could play anybody on stage, pretty much. And when I worked with him, the New Power Generation, I started with him on Nude, and then did Diamonds and Pearls, and if he was telling you how to play an instrument or your instrument, whatever it was, keyboards, saxophones, bass, drums, and you didn't understand, he would show you what he wanted. Nice. He knew how to play your instrument normally better than you. But he had great musicians around him. He was just that kind of guy. And there's times that he played every instrument on certain albums. You know, I mean, he wanted to be a rock star from the start, and he became a rock star.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories about Prince? Because growing up, I've watched the Dave Chappelle show, and he always had these funny skits of true stories of Prince. And I was wondering if you have any.
As a matter of fact, you're funny that you mentioned that, because you probably remember the Dave Chappelle spoof on the basketball game.
Yeah, the basketball.
I was shooting that. I shot that thing.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Really? So could you walk us through that? Because that's one of the
best. It was Eddie Murphy's guys, his brother Fruity and Uncle Ray, and all those guys came in and thought they were going to just overtake, you know, Prince playing basketball and his crew. And ironically, those guys were all dressed up, you know, in gear to play basketball, to do sports. Well, Prince, of all the times I've seen him off stage, he looked like, I mean, he still had his, almost looked like he had his stage gear on. I never seen him dressed in Levi's and, you know, t-shirt. He always looked like he was ready to go on stage. And he was a great basketball player. He was played basketball when he was in high school. But he was so short. It was hard for him to you know, succeed in it. But he was a great basketball player. And man, he really impressed those guys. I mean, they thought they were going to just crush him, but they didn't. They didn't at all. It was a really interesting match. And like I say, I mean, it's ironic because I used to work with Eddie Murphy way back in the day. Back in, I did Eddie Murphy or Raw.
Oh, really?
Yeah, out of the Felt Forum there underneath the Madison Square Garden. But I did his Pieces of My Mind tour and all that stuff. And he was just, it was just so funny to see him, you know, really trying to get it over on Prince. And Prince, like I said, just, I think they were impressed when they saw how he was playing.
Nice.
It was a good, and it's so funny with Dave Chappelle because he's so good with imitating anything from, like I said, some of Eddie Murphy's family, his Uncle Ray and his cousin Fruity and all those guys.
So you're not only videotaping the tour, but is it just Prince? Because I know that Prince videotaped a lot of extra stuff that has never been shown. Was it always like that with these different acts, or was it just like specific to Prince that he had you like film different things?
Every act was different.
Okay.
Let's just say Ozzy, for example. I mean, I started doing Ozzy in 84 with Bark at the Moon. Pretty much at that time, it was right at MTV was a a music channel, and nobody really expected it to succeed. People couldn't imagine. It's like, you're going to play music videos 24 hours a day. I mean, how's that going to work out? You know, and nobody really, you know, saw it coming. And ultimately, it was Michael that injected Thriller and some of those outrageous videos that people gave the music industry a shot in the arm that it really needed at that time. And then all of a sudden, everybody had to have a video. And ironically, the stuff that we shot for Prince was what he did with it. You know, I'll never know. But I shot the live stuff, and then I was shooting stuff for Ozzy. I mean, I started with him in his, you know, in his own band, but I also did Ozzy and with Black Sabbath. I did Osmosis. I did all the Ozfest stuff. So I was with him for quite a bit. And at the time that I was doing the festival stuff with Ozzy, he would end up saying if we were in South America, for example, he wanted to go up to the Christ, you know, the big Christ statue up there on the hill. You know, his manager, Tony, would call me up, say, "Hey, man, we get your stuff. We're going to go up and, you know, just shoot him up there." So a lot of that stuff I shot for MTV.
Okay.
And it would be played on their deal. But which was really cool because I got to travel all these cool places. I'm traveling with, it's Tony, his manager, Jerry, his security guard, myself, and Ozzy. Traveling in his private jet with this little guy with a hatchet on the tail, you know, and you know, traveling around with him all over and whatever you want to do. And that particular time doing that thing with the Christ, it was cool. We hiked all the way up there. And if you got to remember, back in those days, I was working mostly with Sony gear, and the Sony cameras were 37 pounds. And then you had a belt pack, and then you had extra tape. You know, it was condensed. At least it had a recorder in the deck in the camera setup. So it was better because there was years before that you had to carry another separate recorder. You know, you had a camera and then an umbilical cord that hooked to the recorder.
Ooh, okay.
And then a sound guy. So it was just a lot more work and stuff. But with Ozzy on those things, we went to another time that was interesting, that had, he said he wanted to go to the pyramid of the sun and the pyramid of the moon outside of Mexico City. They say they wanted to document it and get all that stuff down on tape and stuff. So I said, okay. And I didn't realize when I started the deal, again, it was, imagine, I'm carrying everything. I'm carrying extra belt pack, you know, battery packs, extra tape, you know, and all the whole, you know, full load of stuff. Like I got, you know, scuba gear on.
But you're going up.
And I'm going up. Each one of those steps is 18 inches high, and there's 1,000 of them going up. And we went up there with a Aztec descendant of one of the, you know, the old descendant, and he was going to do a ceremony at the top, so they really wanted to catch this Aztec ceremony and stuff. And I went all the way up there with him and shot the ceremony. And they gave me some little grain, it was just amazing how they had set those two pyramids were in correlation with the harvest moon, and they knew when to plant their seeds and all that. You know, there was a whole history, a really, really interesting history to all that. And like I said, that we did up there, I shot it, and I got, to this day, so got some of those seeds that they gave me. And this guy, like I said, was a 32nd descendant of one of the people that originally did this. And the way they had designed that whole building and that whole compilation of buildings around there, if you can imagine, they said that there would be 1 million people there at certain times for the guy to the big forget what the
shaman, the priest,
yeah, the big guy to do his speech. And ironically, you could hear him. I mean, the acoustics in those places they designed were just, how'd they do that? It was just totally amazing,
right? In the ancient world, yeah. It's ridiculous because they do a lot of their set up with their cities with astrological archaeology, and then talk about different acoustics in these different temples. And I know that I think there was one in Cambodia that was at. If you hit the rock or the structure in a certain thing, the vibrations of it will go out from it. So I totally believe that in the back of the day, like, you can have a speech or, you know, blood sacrifice or killing somebody on that temple, probably, if it's Mayan, and hear millions of people. So when you're up there, what did you guys, did you do this?
He did the whole ceremony. He had a horn thing that he blew, and he ran through a speech, and like I said, I mean, again, they would go up there to know when they were using it mostly for doing their agriculture,
right?
You know, when to plant and all that, and there would be certain times of the year that they'd do other things, and it was an amazing process. But as we got down off that thing, we walked down all those stairs. Then there's some local vendors down there. I remember, this is a sidebar, but as we came down to these local vendors, people had, you know, beautiful jewelry and people selling different things and whatever. And again, there was a few other people around, you know, other tourists and stuff, but pretty much we were kind of on our own with this guy. This guy was showing us around, but he said, "Man, check this out." So I'm looking at some of the stuff, and I said, "Gosh, that's some beautiful necklaces and stuff." And I, Ozzy's standing next to me, Tony's on this side, and I said, "Man, I think I'll get this for my wife." And, you know, I pay the guy, and Ozzy's kind of checking it out and checking some stuff out, and he sees something that he likes. He says, "Mark," he says, can you loan me some money, man, so I can buy this for Sherritt?" And I'm going, "Okay, sure, man." It's like, you know, and that happened a few times, like stuff like that, because he never carried no money. You know, he never carried anything. Didn't know where he was going. I mean, literally, he, you know, Tony had to say, "We were getting in this truck and we're going here." And, you know, he always had a handler kind of deal with him. And that's the way, you know, that's what happened a couple times that we got separated from people. Like sometimes we get off this private plane and we had to go catch the car to take us to the hotel. There was a time that I was trying to shoot these guys, and there was a mob of, we're trying to go through 1,000 people, and the car is like 100 yards away, and Jerry and there's just a mob around us, all of us, and I'm shooting all this stuff trying to capture it and all that stuff, and Ozzy jumps on Jerry's back. Big Jerry, he's a security guard, and he just says, "Get on my back, we're good." And so he just gets him through that crowd, runs over there. I'm jammed because the whole crowd's around me. I can't get through the guys to follow him to shoot that stuff. But I finally get there just as Jerry's opened the door and puts Ozzy in the car on the passenger side. He shuts the door, and he starts to run around to get into the other side because he couldn't get on that side. By the time he shuts the door, the guy just takes off. The car just takes off. Well, Ozzy doesn't know where he's going. Where the hell's the guy going? You know. Right. So literally, Jerry got into another car and quick tried to catch up with that one. And it's traffic, Mexico City, man. It's like jam-packed traffic. And Jerry gets about a block from the hotel and quick just, and it's bumper to bumper traffic, and he sees Ozzy's just getting ready to pull into the hotel, and he quick just gets out of the car and runs ahead and literally gets there as soon as Ozzy gets out of the car, and Jerry's right there, and Ozzy says, where have you been? He just had no idea that he was, like, you know, left him back of the airport. Jeez, he just happened to be there, because he would have just got out of the car and there would have been a mob of people just swarming him. I mean, right. You know.
So you've been able to have, it seems like, these really unique experiences with the performers that you have. And I would imagine you develop relationships over time. You've had, 40 years of experience of this kind of work. What lessons have you learned, or what have you learned about yourself through this lifestyle that you've created for yourself?
You know, I guess the biggest one is dealing with your family, you know, because always, you know, you if you want to keep your relationship, or, you know, your kids going and that kind of thing, you have to, it takes a lot of work, more so than if you're just a 9-to-5er going back to, you know, every night you're going back to your house and stuff. Some people, that's the life for some people. For me, it wasn't at the time. I mean, the thing with my deal, I would go for months at a time. And in those days, it was very hard to communicate, because there was no FaceTime or any of that stuff, and the telephone calling was very expensive, so it was a limited amount of calling. You know, I was never home for my son's birthday. I missed my daughter's graduation from Oxford University in England. I missed that whole thing. It was really hard on me to miss that. But I was in Russia. I couldn't get away. I missed my kids' graduations. I missed a lot of stuff from my kids. But the difference on that was the downside, but the upside was, when I was home, 24 hours for X amount of time. You know, I was with them 24 hours a day. You know, I drove them to school. I drove them to, did all this stuff with them. So there's a trade-off. You know, I was trying to make a living, doing the best I could with doing what I had. But the biggest thing, like I would say, is to balance your career with your family. Nowadays, it's a lot easier because you have the communication. But in those days, it was tough. And as we spoke before, it's, every woman says she doesn't mind you being away, until you're away a week, a month, many months, you know, and that type of stuff. Then it's hard. It wears on any relationship. So it takes a lot of work.
What else have you experienced that really defines just your outlook on life? Like, you've been around the world, you lived in these amazing places, you know, hung out with these, you know, geniuses, these performers, like, what has it given you, though, like, out of the experience?
I think the biggest thing, I mean, I've had, ever since I've started in this business, the common thread has been in music. And if I wasn't playing music, which, you know, when I first started in this, that was the desire to be a musician, to play and to make money doing it. When I realized that was going to be a tough goal to reach, I kind of went around the other sides of it. And as long as I was around music, you know, and I've diverted a few times, I've gone in TV and movies, all that kind of stuff. But the common thread throughout the years has been basically two things. Music has saved me, even through these hard times that we've been having now. You know, my music and martial arts. I've been in martial arts since the 60s also. I've started, and I went through, my martial arts has been as important to me as my music. And in the early days of my martial art career was the 60s, you know, and I was at, when I used to do tournaments, compete in tournaments, I mean, I was at the internationals in Long Beach, you know, and there was people like Chuck Norris and Bruce Lee and, you know, Joe Wallace and a lot of different people in their day were top of their field in martial arts. And I, to this day, I still communicate with a lot of three or four of my main sifus that I've had throughout the years of all these years with it. So it's helped me between my meditation and just doing forms and keeping my lifestyle balance. Through not only through the epidemic now, but throughout all of my experiences that I've had in the music business too, it's saved my life many times.
Music is can't do that to you.
Yeah.
Whether you're playing, listening, or videotaping, it has that therapeutic sense to it.
I mean, to me, it was, let's just say, when I was a camera guy, there was a specific, you know, certain shots that you remember, you know, that still stick into my mind. Then the one that I'm thinking of right now is, there was a shot that I was crouched down into a low shot with my camera right here, and Prince is running straight at me from stage right to stage left, and he's sliding on his back leg and his knee, and he's like, he's got his guitar like it's a rifle, and he's going to jam it right into my lens.
Okay.
And he comes running across, and he's sliding. And every night he would slide, and he'd stop about 2 inches from the edge of my lens. And I knew I better just, you know, as long as I'm in my spot, I mean, you better be in the right spot, that right cue, because you know he's going to be there. And the same with, like I said, with Michael. Those are the two that I would say of anybody, just consistency. And if you're going to do that shot, then do it every time, and he'll be there. You know, and ultimately, if you are doing it like that, you know, once the artist sees that you have a good shot and develops it, and ultimately they'll end up playing with you. Like Ozzy would throw buckets of water on top of me. I've destroyed four cameras.
Damn. You know?
Okay. Almost got electrocuted. I mean, but that was a gag. And I'm shooting him as he got buckets of water, as he's throwing them right at me. That's the last shot you see of that camera, as the water coming over. But it's a great shot. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, there's those things, man. And it just, I just always had a good time. I mean, I'll do whatever it takes to get the shot. And I learned that early on when I was working in the 60s. And this is way back in the days of, you know, the Monterey Jazz Pop Festival and Altamont and all that stuff, when it was just mass confusion. So some of those, there was a guy that I learned at early on when I very first started my film career, that this guy was he worked for KGO TV in San Francisco, camera guy. And he shot every camera that I knew, you know, back then. I'm talking film in these days, it was film. And he taught me a lot of all that stuff. And there was nothing he wouldn't do to get a shot. And that was the discipline that it took me. Like I said, there was times like, you shoot. It's like, sometimes you might have to hold that little bit longer till they take it, you know, and, you know, I mean, whatever it takes, I'm going to get that shot.
So before we go, Mark, we talked about all your experience with the musicians that you've, you know, been on tour with. If you had a dream scenario, is there anyone past or present that you would want to go on tour with and work with that you haven't already?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I would say I had a friend that toured with this guy. And so I got to know him a little bit, but I just as a fan, you know, always thought about Marvin Gaye. You know, I mean, to me, that's he's unique. He's very unique in his style, and it was just he had an interesting career, and it was tragic how it ended. But like I said, there was just, even when you think of Sam Cooke and Lou Rawl and all those guys in that era, you know, he stood out, I guess. What I was really, I mean, I liked his, you know, his style. And like I said, my friend that I happened to tour with told me a little bit about some of the stuff that he liked with him, and how he, what a pleasure it was to work with him when he toured with him. He's the only other guy that I knew that ever toured with this guy.
Oh, wow.
You know, I mean, in the old days. So I'd say, if anybody, somebody like that, either Sam Cooke or Marvin Gaye, so somebody like that.
Right.
And it's ironic because, you know, back in the day when I would be doing, say, rehearsals with sound checks, I could remember with Steve Perry and Journey, and he was a really big Sam Cooke fan, and to hear Steve Perry singing Sam Cooke song. He was Sam Cooke, and he liked Elvis Presley too. But to hear him do some Sam Cooke stuff with Steve Perry's voice,
right?
It's like, wow, it was unique, you know. Right. Like I say, it's just I've been very, very fortunate to be able to have the memories of hearing an artist not only do his what they're known for, you know, a lot of times, but a lot of times like John Bon Jovi doing somebody that he likes, because he loved, you know, different people, and to hear him doing somebody else's song, and go like, wow, man, that's I mean, it's pretty unique.
You know? That's special. You never get to see that. Yeah, right? Exactly. Especially with a sound check.
Yeah, yeah. And I used to listen to, I used to go out to the Rolling Stones had a A and a B stage, and I would go out to the B stage and just sit out there in the audience, you know, a few rows back from the B stage, and just listen to them do their sound check, and they never play what they're going to play, you know, and they're during the show. They just want to play something different, and just to watch those guys. And I used to. I can remember, I shouldn't have done it, but I used to turn my phone on and just record some of that music. And
I would do the same.
And then I'd send that to somebody and say, hey, yeah, I'm at soundcheck, and this is, you know, Angie or something that the Stones are doing, you know, 10 feet away from me, man. You know, but it was a cool, you know, like I said, I didn't, you know, listen to a lot of people's soundcheck, but the Stones I did, because it was just nice. So interesting. Mick Jagger was always, I had done some other stuff with him, some individual stuff, and he was always such a nice guy. He was a really cool guy, and man, there's another guy that's, hell, he's in his late 70s now, and when I was working with him probably not even 10 years ago, he was in great shape, man. I mean, this guy runs across a stage that's 100 feet wide, and he runs 100-foot thrusts, and he's singing, and he's dancing, at 70 whatever, I mean, he is in pretty damn good shape.
That's impressive.
Yeah, he really was. And like always looked sharp. You know, another guy that's just, you know, you think of course, Keith Richards, but as you know, he's amazing. He survived. But that whole band, I mean, the crazy part about it, when I saw those guys doing sound check, it was like they were still having fun. And that to me, of all the things that you could say about somebody, I mean, I've been with a lot of huge bands that didn't even want to be together. Huh. You know, you just looked at them and they didn't have the mix anymore. They, you know, they'd been together for so long, they didn't have. But those guys, of all this time, still like doing what they're doing.
That's the key to life, you know? Right there. Exactly. Follow your passion and do it. Yeah,
exactly, man.
Well, Mark, it was a pleasure getting to know you, and I hope you're back on the podcast to share some more stories and insights about that. This is Robert Zinni from Five Senses. We had Mark Stutzman here today on the podcast. And for more information, go to fiveensesmag.com. Like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And hopefully at some point this pandemic's over so my glasses doesn't fog up from this mask. Until next time, stay safe and tune in.